Good morning. We're going to talk about Shambhala and the Kalachakra Tantra today a little bit. People may have noticed some people have interesting hand gesture when we're doing the offering mandala. So the ring fingers are the center of the universe, Mount Meru. And the idea is we're offering the whole universe for the benefit of ourselves and others. So these mudras, they're called, have some, you know, they're kind of like, okay, there's the mountain, right? It's kind of interesting. Someone thought that one out, you know? So a little hard to do at first. You can, if people are interested, you can search someone out and say, well, what, how do you do that? Let's see. We pull some fingers back and push others down, and then we have this symbolic universe with Mount Meru at the center. And then sometimes we have our mala, our prayer beads, and they go around like this. There are elaborate ways to do a mandala offering. Sometimes we have actually a plate, a silver plate, and we put gems on it. Sometimes rice, but actually sometimes gems, and then you do certain rings with each kind of part of the universe, and then you top it off with a Dharma chakra, Dharma wheel. It's quite elaborate. People have been to some of the teachings here when we've had the abbot here, or our root teacher, Jada Rinpoche, we've offered mandala. So people would put jewels to help them realize how precious bodhicitta is, the wish for enlightenment, how precious all our teachers are and how precious we are. So we offer it all, and you know, we give it away. Those people that are involved in esoteric teachings of any kind know that if you give it away, you can keep it. If you want to keep it, it will be taken from you. Isn't that true? So you know, by offering up what's called the mandala, the whole universe, then of course the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are delighted, and it pours back into us. But it's not a mechanical ceremony. We really, you know, have to offer and let go and give away. So sometimes there's you know, not, we don't have an offering fancy mandala plate and all that. So we might have a very nice fancy mala, right? So in the Sangha, some people have some beautiful malas, which is nice to use for, particularly for like offering mandala, right? Because then the jewels aren't going to drop off the mandala plate, right? They'll be there. So you can, you know, you twist it around like that, and then it's like you're offering all these precious things. However, when we have a beautiful mala, you don't want to wrap it around your wrist because you'll knock it, right? So if you want to wear, if you have a beautiful mala that helps inspire you, then, you know, you'd wear it like this or something like that, right? Usually if people are wearing robes, they'd have it underneath, because if Dharma is very practical, you know, so if you just wear it like this, that'd be okay if you're sitting down. But if you get up and lean over, it's going to go flying, right? So, like that. I think the present Dalai Lama is the one, maybe I'm wrong, but I've heard, like, popularized kind of wrapping the mala around the wrist like that, you know? Is that what you read too? Yeah. Yeah. And now we have the little wrist malas you can get everywhere, and Nordstrom too, you know, just kind of, which is cool. So that's great. But if you have if you're like me, you're gonna hit it, right, somewhere. So you don't want a super fancy one, unless you're okay. Super fancy ones getting broken, then that's okay. Let go. But so when I wear one, I just have a little. I have like plastic ones, which are, you know, actually. Overall, what people use in the monastery, you know, just little plastic ones, right? Because no one has any money. Or, like, if you're wearing robes, then, like, I have the mala kind of looped around my belt, like that. So you're not banging it. So generally, in if you're wearing robes or in a practice situation, you either and you're not, you know, you're active, then you're. You know, you're wearing it like this. You can wear it around your wrist. That's okay. Obviously, Dalai Lama's wearing around. But if you have a really nice mala, has anybody ever been tough on their mala, broken it? Guess not. I guess I'm the only one. So, yeah, you know. Like that, so it's nice to have when we have beautiful paintings and beautiful things. It's to understand that we're doing it as an offering. So ironically, like we're letting go of our beauty and that, and our offering in that sense, because we're letting go, not holding on to, then we. Become the caretakers of the beauty. We become the caretakers of the gifts, right? That's nice. So sometimes people have a real misunderstanding of Buddha Dharma. They can become attached to like letting go. So they think, well, I should be impoverished and I should be miserable all the time. And if I get anything, I should just kind of dump it right away. And that's... That's a one-sided, that's not correct view, you know. We want the idea of, you know, when we really let go, what we're saying is we're letting go of holding it on from our side, but we're letting into, you know, sharing, right? We're letting into interdependence, which is Shambhala. Also, sometimes it's nice to have really inexpensive malas, and I think we have... maybe some ones from India in the back, which is nice to give a donation for. And then if you're just out walking around and somebody says, what are you doing? And you're going, well, I'm singing some prayers to, you know, for compassion, like that. You know, when people ask you what you're doing, you know, share, you know, you don't say, well, I'm doing my mala. They may not know what a mala is, so you just say, well, I'm doing my prayer beads, I'm trying to generate compassion, I'm singing the song, mantra. You don't have to use mantra, you can just say song of Bodhisattva of compassion, Om Mani Padme Hum. They go, oh. And then you can give them your mala, you know. You can give away your mala, you know, it won't. If you have a really beautiful mala and you want to give it away, you can do that too, you know, but... sometimes it's nicest when walking around to have, you know, just one that you're really okay giving away. Because it can be good practice to sometimes give away something really precious, but generally my teacher always said, you know, don't set yourself up, you know, don't do the like, it will be really good for me if I give away this really precious thing, because then that will work on my attachment, and then I'll have to deal with all my attachment issues, and it'll be good practice. That's kind of Western psychology idea. It's not really a good idea, you know. So if you just, well, maybe it's not, I don't know, maybe it's not even a good Western psychology idea. Don't set yourself up, you know what I'm saying? So if you feel generous, then be generous according to your capacity, because then you set up this kind of funny kind of like, I gave too much hoping that I would work on my attachments, and now I resent that I gave up too much working on my attachments because I still got them, so it didn't do any good, and they got my mala or something. So just Shambhala is very practical. Okay? This, you know, like, you know, if you just, you know, it's very practical. It's nice. So, it's nice to have, you know, I've been recipients of wonderful, you know, malas, and then I was, that people have made over the years, and then it also, I just reflect on their generosity too, you know, like that feels really good. So that's the nice thing about receiving a gift too, you know. Buddhists, we shouldn't be going, no, I don't take any gifts, or no, I'm too humble, I don't take any gifts. No, like, if someone says, you know, please, you know, like the Buddha, when the Buddha would go around, you know, particularly for alms rounds, people would put things in the bowl, right? Big Buddha bowl, they would walk around, and still do in Southeast Asia. Didn't work in Tibet, too cold. But, you know, people would just put things and you'd say, thanks, whatever, right? So, you know, we wouldn't say, you know, generally no thanks. But so it's okay if someone, you know, gives you something, and then you can remember that generosity for a long time. Isn't that nice? Yeah. The Dalai Lama has given the Kalachakra Tantra, I don't know, like 35, 40 times now. Kalachakra Tantra is, you know, centered on actualizing or going to or realizing Shambhala. Shambhala is the mythical kingdom that in the West is sometimes understood as Shangri-La, like that. we're doing Shambhala here, you know, the temple and the practice are an expression of the Kalachakra Tantra and the Shambhala vision. The Shambhala vision that the Dalai Lama promotes, you know, has a strong ethical basis to start with. You know, he's very much into let's do, not he, but hopefully we too, you know, into dialogue as much as possible. We're not generally advocating war. He's into sustainability for the planet as much as possible. Into intellectual, individual, intellectual pursuit, individual initiative, not just depending on huge organizations. My own teacher said, you know, please create five Dharma centers in Sacramento rather than one big one. Okay, because he liked the kind of you know, spreading it out a little bit. This is one small one so far. Actually, it looks big. Now it's looking, you know. So, you know, so it's the Shambhala territory isn't just one centralized thing. So it's actually many small villages with one central mansion. The central mansion is symbolic of our awareness, right? Our realization, our compassion. That's the central, isn't it? And then we have all creative kind of places in the landscape that we go. So this is one of our small villages here, and the idea is to have in Sacramento at least five. Actually, we have two. We have a Sangha House in Orangeville, so one, two. Just three more. That's easy, right? Yeah. So so people don't think that it's all a centralization. I like to be a mandala approach, which is that we have a center like the hub of a wheel, and then the energy patterns are like the spokes, right? And then the circumference, right? I wasn't good at geometry. Circumference of the circle. That's what turns and expresses the energy. So we need a lot of spokes on the wheel, but you need at least five. Does anybody have a sports car with five? At least five things, right? Okay. The other part of Shambhala is to promote spiritual and material regular Western science together. So Dalai Lama usually talks about, particularly Robert Thurman too, likes to talk about the Buddhism as a science of inner work, a spiritual science. So Dalai Lama particularly likes to talk to neurobiologists and there's a whole group of people called neuro-Buddhists now who are kind of like into like, you know, how does your MRI, how's your brain look on meditation, right? Then fifth is religious diversity. That's really important because people are just going to have different ways they're going to express their devotion. So the spirituality, which is like space, is just open. Everyone has the same. But religion, which I like too, means primarily like your devotion, like you're particularly devoted to something. So even in this sangha, some people might say, I'm really devoted to my Tara practice. And that's, you know, so you're very devoted to one and you do it religiously. And even in Buddhist sanghas, people go, yeah, I'm really devoted to just meditating on my breath. That's all I do. That's my religion, is my breath. Other people say, no, I'm really devoted to, you know, my artwork. That's my Dharma practice. Or I'm really, walking meditation is it. That's how I'm going to, you know, so that's your religious practice, right? That's religion, is when you get devoted to kind of one thing, you get emotionally involved, and can have the downside too. You can get attached to it, right? So that aspect of religion, we have to know that the diversity is good. We have to say, wow, that's really neat. You're going to bring yourself and the world to religion through walking around. You could do that. Say, I'm just doing walking meditation. I'm just walking. I'm just realizing walking. Or I'm just sitting. Like Zen people like to say, are any Zen people in the town here? You got any Zennies here? No. You just say just sitting in Zen, right? Some people might say, I'm just singing. Oh, we even have a name for that, mantrayana, you know, the way of singing. That's it, I'm singing, you know. I like to say sing and sit here, so I got two things. So that's our religion, you know, it's religion, that's devotion, but it's diversity. But I'm also like, usually Dalai Lama just talking generally ethically, but in Shambhala way two, we have like a sixth thing. Closest idea is maybe paradise. So Shambhala is a paradise. So a paradise, heaven is like beautiful and creative, playful, blissful, energetic, pleasurable, right? Paradise. What else? Did I miss anything? Beautiful, creative, blissful, exciting, pleasurable, good food. dancing, beautiful clothes. you know, nice animals. I don't know, you know. Yeah, paradise, right? So, and sometimes people misunderstand and Buddha Dharma, they say, well, there are no heavens. There are heavens, you know. We say heavens generate just from relative karma, are relative and impermanent. They fade too. It's just like good moods. Good moods are heavens, right? You're having a good day, you're in heaven. You know, doesn't always last. That's heaven realms. But the pure lands like Kalachakra, like Dewa Chen, are generated as a result of our compassion and wisdom, as a result of our bodhicitta, our aspiration for all people to be free and awake and happy. So these can be permanent abodes, and that's Shambhala. So in Shambhala, we have all these, and we have the paradise too. Particularly in our tantric tradition, we combine wisdom and compassion. You know, there are like chemicals, and what's generated from wisdom and compassion when it comes together. The bliss world, yeah. That's paradise, right? Those two come together. Other religious traditions, even within Buddhism, tend to emphasize just chilling out a little bit, not harming, right? So talking about nirvana, there's not a lot said about nirvana other than it's peaceful, right? But we say it's peaceful and beautiful and creative and blissful and fun. We need fun. We absolutely must have. I think if we just are just peaceful and just good people, there's something missing. We need excitement, we need bliss, we need pleasure. But the excitement and bliss and pleasure are based on sharing, are based on interdependence, are based on wisdom. That makes sense, right? It's easy. So this Shambhala has all the energy and power of meditation and wisdom and ethics and common sense, and people are enjoying themselves. So primarily, you know, here, like we tried an experiment, had a Dharma dinner here last night, and it was blissful. So Holly isn't here today, but really praises to Holly. So you may have some other nice words: blissful, pleasurable, creative, beautiful, energetic. I don't know. Dress nicely. What? Nice animals. Good food. Right. So in our practice of Shambhala, of Kala Chakra, which means time wheel, we want to bring everything into harmony, everything into interdependence. And we want it all. We do want it all, right? Yeah. If you do want it all, that's good. But if you really want it all without choking on it, you have to get it in a certain disciplined way. Disciplined way. Yeah. You can't kind of just eat the pizza of Shambhala too fast. you can't like chug it. It's not a pie eating contest. It's not a hot dog eating contest or egg eating contest. Some of us my age, you remember like movie Cool Hand Luke, where you know, couldn't eat eggs for like a year after that. Or hot dogs, you know. So we're really interested in enjoying our lives, but we realize to enjoy our lives with others without harming others does take wisdom and does take a certain amount of discipline. And actually we enjoy ourselves more when we just don't gulp down our food, isn't that so? Then you can really taste it. So that's where the formal practice comes in. What I've been talking about is like the view, the overview. The formal practice comes in by learning how to attune ourselves, to get into tune. The way we get into tune is through these different yogas, inner and outer yogas. And the basic way I talk about being in tune is through rhythm, We have a heart rate, we have a breath rate, we have a brain rate, we have a spiritual heartbeat, right? So when we're in tune with that, when we're without rhythm, it not only fulfills the functions we need to do in daily life, but also we're in Shambhala. So I'm really glad that, you know, now we're doing, you know, singing and rhythm to start the service here. And when we're doing the prayers, that's still rhythm. And hopefully half of you is paying attention to your breath while I'm talking, right? So when you're listening to Lama's talk, always don't lose yourself. Always think like, okay, I'm listening and I'm also paying attention to my breath, right? That makes sense, right? So usually just educationally wise, you say, well, just listen, and we furrow our brow and try to figure it out. But from a tantric point of view, if you're still in rhythm, if you're still doing your mantra or just in your heart rhythm or spiritual rhythm, then you can actually attune better with even being what's said intellectually. Because you're in tune with yourself, therefore you can understand even just a talk like this easier. So it's good I'm talking about this, right? Does it make sense? Because in America, when you come here a Dharma talk, it's usually you're going back to college or high school and we're presenting information, but it's not supposed to be that. The Dharma talk's supposed to be like connecting with the rhythm you've already established through, you know, meditating and singing and establishing the motivation and view in the prayers, right? And then you're in this kind of resonant vibration, and then when the Lama presents things, it resonates, right? Just that term. We have a new program, Tonglen for World Peace, and I think 13 people were there, right? Very nice number. So I'm going to try doing that once a month on October 20th, right? Yeah. So that's... 30th? Yeah, October. It's already October. Somebody like, wow, it's October 1st, okay. And we're doing the Lotus Sutra, right? So all these practices come together. They all weave together so that we can be in Shambhala, you know, be in the combination of bliss, wisdom, and compassion. It's easy, right? So let me see if there's some questions or comments or complaints. That's okay.
What's the difference between pure world, pure land rather, and Shambhala?
Shambhala is a pure land. It is a pure land. Yeah. Patala is a pure land of Chenrezi, or Devachan's the pure land of Amitabha. Yeah. So Pure Land is the people's practice is sustaining it. So it isn't, it's based on realization, so it isn't just based on mood or karma, which is still pretty nice. I mean, when we're in a good mood, we shouldn't say, oh, this is just a mood, I'll get out of it. No, what is? Well, all pure lands are proactive. How do you mean proactive?
Well, but we're actually an active in daily life.
Yes.
Awaiting for some realization.
Yes. It can be talked about sometimes metaphorically as, you know, actually some other place you actually go after physical death, too. So it can be talked about that way, too. But yes, from inner yoga point of view. It's something we're constantly enacting. That's right. Yeah. Good idea. Yeah. When there's silence, it means everyone's understood completely. That's what it means. Hello?
I have a question about the Dharma Center. I'm working to get more families to come in, my little family, Sangha. So we can help each other be better parents.
Yeah. The purpose of a temple here is we need places where it's easier for large people to gather. You know, it's just easier, but also generates a lot of energy. And you know, we do generate energy by coming together, but we also need to generate energy in our own particular household and village, so to speak, right? So in Shambhala, they sometimes say there's 84,000 villages. Because there are 84, you know, sometimes traditionally we say there are 84,000 paths to realization. So you can stick something up on the bulletin board saying, hey, moms, are you? I'm a mom. Like that. So I do expect, you know, people to get together informally too, you know, to practice. So it isn't just like you can only come here. You should be, you know, the temple practice is community and family practice. It's not monastery. It's not retreat center. It's not classroom. Retreat center is like you really go off somewhere and you just do your practice 24/7, right? So, and it's quiet. This isn't quiet. Monastery is sometimes combination of study, but overall monastery that is most understood in the West, a monastery is meant, how do you get along with other people? So in the West, we think monk or nun usually means being a hermit, right? People think like, you know, a simple hermit. No, that's called being simple hermit. Monk means you learn how to get along with 5,000 other people on the same level as you are. It's totally different than like, I'm going to go to my own house because that's good. I've seen enough of them and now I'm going home to my place. No, in monastery, you're just still all, you know, so it's very, very powerful practice, but we're not monastery, we're a temple. Temple means people are kind of coming and going and you know, the mantra kind of I have, we'll put on the new website, is it's training for real life. So you do want to practice here to get inspired, to get teachings, but you also, you know, the home practice or practice where you're getting together with friends and, you know, putting together informal, you know, satsangs is very important. Yeah, my own teacher was kind of... He witnessed the destruction of the monasteries in Tibet, and he said it had been the monasteries in Tibet were these incredible universities and retreat centers, but because they were so concentrated, they were easy to be destroyed. So he was very big on, of course, having a place to centralize and get together, but also being in one's home. Yeah, getting together. Yep, good question. It's easy. Hello. What was the first one?
How does Shambhala compare to other heavenly realms?
Technically, Shambhala and or Potala or Sukhavati are not heaven realms, because Buddhism recognizes heaven realms, but they're still, just based upon impermanence, right? So Shambhala is like the positive way of expressing nirvana. Usually nirvana is expressed like, abandoned ignorance, abandoned, jealousy, abandoned pride, it's usually abandoned false self, right? It's usually expressed kind of negatively. But yeah. So, which is important too. Sometimes we just need to hear the be attached to anything teaching, Like emptiness means just, but emptiness means also fullness. So you shouldn't think, well, we're not in Shambhala unless we're in a good mood and we're enjoying fine food, So Shambhala can be also like, we don't have anything to eat too, right? So we see in 12 step, it's like God always answers prayers, and sometimes the answer is no. Okay? so it means, so Shambhala doesn't mean like, I'm having a bad day, so I'm not in Shambhala. No, Shambhala means we're seeing the inherent richness of our lives, whether it's, through gain or loss, pleasure or pain. So it's a very profound vision, but it's the positive side of nirvana, yeah. It's like living, trying to say, well, what would living nirvana look like? Yeah. So on the Buddha's deathbed, he was also not just saying, work out your own practice with diligence, things are impermanent. He also commented on how beautiful the flowers were, right? There were flowers falling, He said, oh, they're gorgeous, right? So sometimes people focus a little bit too much on the moral side or the a little bit of the restricting side, like you're always, just a little bit the ascetic side, and that's important too. So, but there's the enjoyable side too. But Shambhala really is totally the middle way. So if you see it correctly, Shambhala would also be like, I'm stuck on the Bay Bridge and I have to go to the bathroom, right? I mean, that's right. I don't know. Anybody ever been there? It's like, you really see if your practice is working, or you're on a bus going to Dharamsala from New Delhi. There's this bus that you can fly now. I know a couple of people here maybe have ridden that bus, So, a couple of times when I've taken the bus, there's no bathroom on the bus. And it's okay going, but then it starts winding around, That's Shambhala too, right? You have to do some practice to see that as Shambhala, because you think, it will be Shambhala when they let me out of the bus. But there's also seeing properly, that's Shambhala too, right? Yeah. I know, that takes work. Yes. It's Shambhala because we're bringing together the wisdom and compassion and generating the bliss at the same time. There's a wisdom mind, there's the great compassion, and there's the great bliss of freedom. So that's it. If some places, from a relative point of view, of course we can talk about Shambhala as like looking like Shangri-La, right? But the real Shambhala is like wherever you are is the center of the universe. Yeah. Otherwise, we're just in relative truth. Like, I like it when I like it, and I don't like it when I don't like it. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, equanimity is one of the major meditations we do, right? One of the Brahma Viharas. And it's also equanimity on an inner meditation like samadhi, right? It's equanimity. So, and as we say in Mahamudra, like everything has one taste, the taste of liberation, you know, like that. When you're riding on, you know, like just very practical, when you're riding on a bus that's curving around, almost falling over the cliff, and you have to go to the bathroom, it really doesn't help to generate, I hate this. Okay? You know, you it doesn't help. You know, we just practically realize that that doesn't help. You know, but we don't have to generate, you know, Shambhala isn't saying, I have to like it. Right? So you're present with that. It's really blissful when we're not trapped between like and dislike. So when we say bliss in Vajrayana, it's the bliss of totality and the bliss of liberation, which is fantastic. So it's not just a pleasurable bliss. Yeah. It makes it worse when we're in pain and we go, I hate being in pain, right? Yeah, makes it worse. Should we take a short break? Oh, one more. Yeah.
It sounded to me like you were saying it's Shambhala because you are there and you are present in your Shambhala and not from the external condition. Is that a misunderstanding?
It's true on one level, but the next step in Tantra is even the external conditions are part of Shambhala, you see. So, you know, we might be really having a horrible day and say, well, inner is my Shambhala and out still sucks. But actually, real Shambhala is the outer Shambhala too. That's called pure view. I can't say it's easy, you know, but when the inner and the outer balance out, there's an incredible liberation, you know. But it doesn't, when we're saying Shambhala, it really is, you know, transcendent in the sense that we're not on one side or the other. It's true interdependence. So interdependence, pratijja samuppada, which is the Buddha's realization, is not on one side or the other. And, of course, that's very difficult for us human beings. We generally want to be on one side or the other. Isn't that so? You know. But actually, we're always in the middle. Yeah. Let's take like 5 minute break a little bit, stretch, and then we'll do sitting. Okay. Yeah. Vajrayana tradition is when we're gathering as a group and doing singing or offering pujas or talks. Generally, we don't do long meditations because the main point is the teaching and the prayers and the singing. And usually, you know, at home or on our own time, then we're doing the long meditations. I know in America, like, maybe because it's Dharma's new, you know, some Dharma centers, you know, start out with an hour or 45 minutes. We've done some long ones here too, actually, but usually Sundays is like, you know, 20 minutes, 18 minutes, something like that, you know, because almost everybody can kind of handle that, right? But there's, you know, like in TM, they used to say 20 minutes or something, right? They still say that? Anybody know TM? But I generally say start with small for something you can do every day and then build on that. So I'm still on 6 minutes. But I do more than 6 minutes, but I figure like everything after 6 minutes is just gravy, yeah. So a real mistake is to, you know, overpromise and undeliver to ourselves. You know, we all make these kind of New Year's resolutions. I'm going to sit an hour every day, you know, or then I'm gonna get to the gym 3 times a week, do yoga 3 times a week, finish the novel, you know. So just, you know, start very small as the promise, and then, you know, when you have time, do more, right? sometimes more, if you're doing it right, whatever that means, yes, more is better, okay? But if you're straining, you know, if you're doing Dharma as a self-improvement project, then it's too difficult. If you're doing perfection as self-improvement project, it makes your life very difficult. So the nice part, when we sit longer, we're just sitting longer, 6 minutes, right? Isn't that nice? Easy. So please enjoy. Traditional Dharma practice always starts with creating a very positive environment, imagining, visualizing, feeling that your friends, relatives, the Buddhists and Bodhisattvas are delighted that you're practicing. That's very traditional, and I think it's helpful, so you create a very supportive environment, so you just don't sit down and do stress reduction meditation. You're really feeling like supported, and then we sing, we do the prayers and singing, so we establish the energy and rhythm, and then of course we do some yoga practice, meditation, and then we dedicate it. So we say, may everyone benefit from my practice. If you don't dedicate it traditionally, it's not beneficial. So it's beneficial because you're willing to share it. That makes sense, right? Easy. We do a lot of programs here, and a lot of my students doing programs now are really delighted. Usually call the facilitators like, practice leaders or facilitators, right? We also have people that are in training to be chaplains, help people with many practice and transitional things in their lives, both ceremonial and crisis. So we have a new chaplain in training, Dana Ferry. That's no escape. It's nice, it's good. I'm really interested in Lion's Roar of turning out chaplains rather than teachers or lamas or something. In this culture, when someone gets the brand teacher, they start becoming like, I know it all, and now I've got to give people advice. You know, it's dangerous, let alone lama, that's really dangerous, So chaplains like the shepherd bodhisattva, though I talked about styles of bodhisattva a couple of weeks ago, king style, emperor style is you get enlightened first, fairy style is you go with others at the same time. Shepherd style is everyone can go before you. So actually in the chaplain training, we start with emperor style because we have to finish and do the two-year foundations course, right? And then we do kind of the fairy style of going along, practicing along with others. And then finally, we can do the shepherd style. So it's funny, shepherd style actually comes last, in our real training, because it's so nice to say, I've been there, so why don't you take my car or take my path or I'll wait for you, go ahead, or take my mala, like that. So the chaplain is not teaching or having to be higher than, right? A lot of times people say, I'm a teacher now and then higher. So, chaplain style is like shepherd style, right? But it starts, you have to actually know a few things and then practice along with others, and then you can just listen and help, right? That makes sense, right? Yeah, nice. So you don't really attain, you don't start off shepherd, fairy, emperor, empress. You start off and in a way, you come back to being shepherd. It's nice. Okay.